complete change in his personality and his attitudes. And he never took another drink. And I says, what was the cause? He says, I don't know what the cause was. But he said he was loved by everybody. He became the mayor of this little town and everybody loved him. And I says, what am I going to do? He says, all I can do is pray that I can find out why this thing happened to him. Now we in AA call this a sudden spiritual awakening, which happens to maybe one out of every 10,000 of us. But it is possible. Well, I says, what's going to happen to me? He says, oh, most likely you're going to die in the gutter. I says, oh, is that right? And he says, yeah. So I started walking away, and he says, just a minute. Just a minute, I want to tell you something. He says, Al, I want to tell you something. It's not a sin to drink, but it's a sin to be a glutton. And anybody that tells you anything else don't know what they're talking about. And you know, that was a great thing for me and still is. It's not a sin to drink, but it's a sin to be a glutton. And I went my way. And of course, the wife divorced me, which was maybe the greatest favor that ever happened to anybody. And I wandered around, and finally I ended up in a $2-a-week room on the south side of Los Angeles at Arlington and Venice on the northwest corner above a grocery store. And in the meantime, I had met a wonderful gal. And it turned out that she was the only friend I had left in the world. Cecilia Johnson. My friends had fluffed me off. And this is a matter of a few years in here. I had deteriorated down the pike to the point where I couldn't get any work except maybe once in a while in a B picture. And then that damn collection agency grabbed my check before I'd get to it about half the time. My own family wouldn't write to me anymore. Everything was upside down. Everything. They talk about being in depressions. Hell, I was in depression 24 hours a day. It was just simply awful. It was terrible. I was in and out of jail so much that it was just like a second home to me down there, although I didn't like it. But when I'd come out of one of my blackouts here, I'd be down in Lincoln Heights. And I don't know about you, but I used to have these blackouts that would last for a week at a time, and I couldn't only tell you maybe about two or three things that happened in the week previous. I was absolutely out of my mind. I was a walking zombie. Why I didn't kill a lot of people with that car, I don't never know. I was driving around without a driver's license. I had an old beat-up Pontiac 34, I guess it was, and the fenders were just flopping like I was flying, but when I was drunk, it felt like a Rolls Royce. You know, it was beautiful. Everything was upside down, and then I got into a real bad jam. And I ended up doing, well, I was got 60 days, and I did 30. And I said, if I ever drink again, I'm going to kill myself. And you know, you and I will never know how many members of the alcoholic people commit suicide. There were two very dear friends of mine who had over 20 years in AA. And there were these guys that had all the answers. And they didn't have any action. They never went to meetings anymore. And one of them lived in Arcadia, old Bill. Only time he'd go to the meeting when I'd be out in that area speaking some night, why, I'd pick up Bill and he'd go with me. And old Bill was married to a gal who he married after he got sober. And she never saw Bill drunk. And he was a mean old bastard anyway. Even sober, he was mean. And you know, old Bill fell and broke his hip or something, or his leg. And Mother, as he called his wife, had put him into the vet's hospital, and he was so mean out there, they threw him out. And she put him into a private hospital, and he was so mean there, they threw him out. So she got a wheelchair for him and kept him at home. And one day he said to her, Mother, the pain is so terrible, I think I'd better have a drink of booze. So she went and got him a fifth, being very dumb about booze. And no time at all, he was drinking 3/5 a day. Ha! Laying in bed, drinking 3/5 a day. So one morning, Mother called me up, and she said, Al, what should I do? And I said, why, what's the matter? And she says, well, Bill is screaming at me, and he wants a drink before he even drinks his coffee. How naive can you be? Well, I says, listen, I got my nose into a family ruckus one time, and I had it cut right off. So you do what you think is right. She says, well, I'm not going to give him his coffee and give him a drink before I give him his coffee. And he kept threatening her that he was going to commit suicide if she didn't give him that drink. And by God, he did. He killed himself. Half hour later, she called up and she says he committed suicide. He had a pillow, had a revolver under the pillow on his bed, and he knocked himself off. And I said, did you call the cops? She says, the cops are here right now, and the bullet was laying on the floor underneath the bed. Now, there's an example of a guy with over 20 years of sobriety. Over 20 years, hadn't been to maybe four or five meetings in 10 years. Reverted right back to the old routine again. And then there was another friend of mine out in Santa Monica. And you know that guy, I won't go into the whole story, but he had over 20 years. And he was a very popular speaker and a hell of a guy. And he gassed himself in his car after having been drunk for 6 months. And these things, I think, are sort of lessons to you and me. That what can happen to us, because we never get better, we always get worse. The disease gets worse even if we're sober. It gets worse. And when we start drinking again, we're just that much further gone than we were before, as they tell me. Now, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous actually gives us a 100% guarantee that we're going to get sober and stay sober the rest of our lives if we live according to certain conditions as honest as we possibly can. Alcoholics Anonymous gives us a 100% guarantee that we will stay sober the rest of our lives if we live according to certain conditions, which are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as honest as we possibly can. And it says in the book, if we don't think we have the ability to be honest, the willingness to try to be honest alone will do the job. And something happens to you and me if we just put in just a little bit of effort, just a tiny bit of effort of honestly trying to live these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as honest as we possibly can. And we have a change in our personality, which is unbeknownst to us, but is recognized by our family and our close friends. And we stay sober. And it's a miracle. It's a miracle. As Bill says in the three pertinent ideas, which are the 12 steps, really, admitted we were alcoholic, and two, probably no human power could help us, and leave out the probably, no human power could help us, that God could and would if sought. And you know what we're doing? If we put in the action of trying to live these 12 steps to the best of our ability, we are actually seeking God, whether it's unbeknownst to us or not. We are actually seeking God. And by doing this, the miracle happens. Because no power could help us that God could and would have sought. And God is the only one that can cause this miracle, which happens to you and me. And the whole spiritual concept of AA, and I don't know what your interpretation of spiritual is, but my interpretation is anything that is good, anything that is positive, is spiritual. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual fellowship because everything about it is good. The philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual philosophy because everything about it is good and positive. Also, we find out it's the most practical way to live in the world. Practicality and spirituality are exactly the same things. The spiritual man is the practical man because he does what he's supposed to do when he's supposed to do it. And that's sort of been the thing that I've gone on. Do what I'm supposed to do when I'm supposed to do it, and everything seems to turn out just fine. And action is the magic word. We take action. We start getting honest with ourselves. We start practicing these steps in all our phases of our daily life. And the miracle happens. In other words, we're doing the footwork and God's taking care of the rest. And He's performing this miracle because we're honestly trying. We're honestly trying. So I'll get back to this little story of mine. I got on the worst drunk of my life. My last drunk was always the worst drunk of my life. And I'm living in this $2 a week room above a grocery store. And catty corner across the street is a bar and a liquor store. And I fixed myself a nice cuff over there where I could get $150 worth of drinks before they'd cut me off. And I always paid them first when I came in. When I ever got a check, I paid them first. And you know, it got so bad that I would be passed out by noon every day. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I was down at this little bar, and the bartender was an alky. And I'd help him clean the joint out and clean out the spittoons and mop the joint up, and I'd sit up on the stool, and he'd throw one down, and I'd throw it back at him, and after about four of them, I'd hold it down, and then I'd stay there and get drunk, go next door, get a jug, and crawl across the street and crawl up those stairs and pass out on the bed. And this went on for many weeks, and I was trying to commit suicide. I lost 30 pounds, I was out of my mind. And if I didn't pass out by noon, I had the DTs, so I didn't want to have the DTs. Well, I was on this drunk old Jack, my old drinking pal from across town, called me up on a phone, March 1st of 1941, and he says, "Al," he said, "have you seen the Saturday Evening Post this week?" And I said, "No, why?" He says, "There's an article in there about a group of people in New York called Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "It says Alcoholics Anonymous, and they help one another." And he says, "It shows a guy lying in bed, and another fellow's looking down at him." And he says, "He most likely brought this guy some medicine." And he says, "They're doing exactly the same thing that you and I used to do, only there's 100 of them. They've stolen our idea." And I says, "That's great." He says, "100 of them in this thing." And I says, "My God." He says, "Yeah." He says, "If some guy's on his bazooka, the other guy goes over and helps him. And then when he's down, this fellow goes and helps him when he's sober." He says, "Just like a daisy chain." I said, "Just like a union." He said, "Just like a union." I says, "Isn't that wonderful? We'd better get to New York." I said, "Is there any more to the article?" And he says, "No." He says, I'm pretty drunk and I can't read the small print right now." So old Jack, about 3 weeks later, he called me up and he says, "Hey, I found this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. They got a chapter out here." I says, "No kidding." And he says, "Yeah." He says, "I was down the liquor store cuffing for a jug of wine, and one of the local drunks was paying part of his bill. I got him by the elbow and took him outside, and I says, 'Hey, what are you paying your bill for? You want to ruin it for the rest of us around here?' And the guy says, 'Well, I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm making amends.' So he says, 'I went to a meeting, and I've been sober a week.' And I says, 'Oh, my God, you're sober a week?' And he says, 'Yeah.' I says, 'The worst psychopathic drunk in the world, and you're sober a week.' I says, 'If you can stay sober a week, I'm a cinch for a lifetime. Send him over. I want to talk to him.' He says, 'Oh, no, you have to call him.' So I got his name and his phone number, and I called him. And he says, 'I'll be over tomorrow afternoon.' I says, 'Don't bother. I'll be passed out.' He says, 'What do you mean?' And I says, 'Yeah.' 'Come in the morning.' He says, 'Still giving orders.' I says, 'No, I'll be passed out.' So the damn fool came in the afternoon, and I was passed out just as I offered it. I'm an honest man, you know. And he came over there 3 days in a row, and I was passed out. So he got a hold of the old landlady. Her name was Woodbury, and she was 90 years old. And she knew booze like nobody because their whole family were drunks. And she got me sober. And the guy came over on a Wednesday night, and he talked and he talked and he talked. And I didn't like this guy at all. I just didn't like him at all. And he never gave me a chance to talk at all. All he did was brag. And when he's getting ready to go, he says, 'I'll pick you up Friday night.' I said, 'Just a minute. I haven't decided to join this clique of yours, this deal.' I says, 'It's most likely some damn cult. We've got 8 million of them here in Southern California.' I says, 'You don't know who I am. I'm a college graduate, man. You can't feed me this malarkey. I want to know why. I want to know what this is. And I'm maybe the greatest trombone player that ever walked this earth, too.' And I says, 'You can't give me that stuff. I'm going to the library and find out about this. It might be a bunch of kooks.' Which damn near it was, if you want to know the truth. So he says, 'Okay,' and he wrote out the address, and he says, 'I'll see you there Friday night.' So Friday night came, and I called my girlfriend, Cecilia, and I says, 'Will you go down with me?' And she says, 'Yes, I sure will.' So we went. Of course, I was afraid to drive that car a block, you know, those fears. Oh, God. Walked to the door, and the guy says, 'Do you want to stay sober on an all-time basis?' And I says, 'You betcha.' So he let me in. They screened you right at the door. If you hesitated a little bit, I saw him telling guys, 'Get the hell out of here and make up your mind. If you want to stay sober on an all-time basis, you can come back.' Wonderful, wonderful. So I went, sat down in the front row, and I got a hold of one of the older guys there, and I says, "Hey, my sponsor, so-and-so." He says, "Oh, he got drunk last night." I says, "Hooray." Didn't like the bastard anyway. And then the guy that was up here talking this first night, he was a preacher or something. All he did was quote the Bible. He should have been on a soapbox out there in the park. You know, it was just awful. And I turned to the guy sitting next to me. I'll never forget his name, Charlie Swearinger, a little guy. And I says, "I'm going home. I can't see where this is going to help me at all. All you need is sawdust on the floor, and you've got a Main Street mission." Well, he said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, listen, give yourself a break. Stick around for the rest of this meeting and come back to at least 8 meetings before you make a decision of whether you think this is going to help you or not." Pardon me. And I says, "Well, I'll just show you." So I stayed. And thank God I stayed. And I met some wonderful guys, and among them was a guy by the name of Pete Cunningham, who kind of took me in tow. He was 2 weeks ahead of me. And that's the way it was. You were an old-timer if you were 2 weeks ahead of the other guy. And it was beautiful. And everything went along just fine. But I didn't get any work. I had it real rough. The undersheriff was dropping by and saying, "Get that money to your ex-wife or we're going to put you on the Biscaloose Road Building Project." That was the county road building project out there. Everybody's on my neck all the time. I'm walking down the street. I see my friends. They cross the street to avoid me. Everything was bad. I can't get any work. I made $1,400 the first year I was sober. But you know that after a few years, I got to looking back at that. And you know what? That was all God's will. This is the way it was supposed to be. God was taking care of me. I had to go through what I had to go through, whether I liked it or not. God knew, the power greater than myself knew, that if I got going back in those studios and making those thousands of dollars every week, that I'd be drunk again. So I didn't get the work. And I'll never forget, I stood up in the meeting one night with these old mean old men, and I says, "I used to make more money when I was drinking." And one of the mean old guys says, "Well, go back to drinking." And I says, "I don't want to." He says, "Okay, sit down and shut up." Very good. So after about 6 months of this, I went to the leader of the group at that particular night. His name was Frank Randall. He was sort of second in command. And we down there owe a lot of our sobriety to this guy. He was a real tough mug, but he was great. And I said, do you know anybody in the music business? And he said, "No, why?" And I said, "I need a job real bad, and I thought you might have an angle." He says, "My boy, this is not an employment agency. This is a place to stay sober." He says, "What's your number one problem?" And I said, "Alcohol's my number one problem." He said, "Okay, take care of your number one problem, and everything else will take care of itself when it's supposed to." He says, "You might not get a job for 5 years the way you've kicked these people around, but you'll eat and you'll have a roof over your head. And from now on until they put you 6 foot under, worry about one thing, your number one problem. And you'll get everything in this world that you deserve and most likely a lot more." And no truer words were ever said. No truer words were ever said. I got everything in this world that I deserved and an awful lot more. An awful lot more. You see, that's the answer to everything. That's the answer. If I take care of my number one problem, everything else will take care of itself. Because if I take care of my number one problem, I have to put in action on these 12 steps. And nothing bad can happen to me if I do that. Everything works out beautiful, and I don't think there's been a day gone by since that time that I don't think of that one thing. Take care of your number one problem, and everything else will take care of itself. And it always does, and it always will, as long as I put in the action and put in the effort, and God will take care of the rest. Now, along about this time, I was in the music business real heavy. And I made a wonderful, fine living in the business. And about 1955, I had decided that possibly I would like to get out of the music business. And I'd been playing the trombone for 40 years. I taught at the Los Angeles Conservatory for many years, made a nice dough down there, had some fine students. And I was just, the thrill was gone, if you understand. I knew all there was to know about it, I thought, and the thrill was gone. So I met an old friend of mine who was a pro football player from Chicago who was in the real estate business in Los Angeles. I ran into him on the street in Hollywood one night, and he specialized in selling motels and hotels. And he's pretty drunk. Of course, I'm an AA then. And he's pretty drunk. And he said, come on over to the office tonight. I'd like to see you. He says, I just broke up with my partner, and I'd like to talk to you. So I got over to the office that night at 7 o'clock, and he's drunker than a goat. He's a great big bull, about 300 pounds, but a sweet man, a real sweet man. And he talked me into going into selling motels with him. And he showed me what he was doing, a fabulous, fabulous net he came out with every year. And I looked him over, and he was about as much salesman as, just not a salesman at all in my eyes. So I thought, Christ, if he can make $50,000 a year, I'm a cinch for $100,000, you know. So I went back to my home, and my wife, Cecilia, God bless her, I said, I'm going to start selling motels in the morning. And she says, well, what are you going to do about the music? I says, oh, I'm going to quit. She says, just like that? And I says, just like that. She says, what makes you think that you can sell motels? Well, I says, I'm sober. Well, is that all? I says, yeah. I'm just as good as anybody else, so long as I'm sober. I'm just as smart as anybody else, so long as I'm sober. And she says, well, it's okay with me. And I says, sure, it's okay with you, because I'm going to sell motels. So I went down the next day, and I went down and started the school. In 6 weeks, I had my license, and I went to work with Randy selling motels. And I made a fortune selling motels. We alcoholics have something about us, boy. When we go after something, we go after something. And I worked my ass off, if you want to pardon my French. And everything just boomed, and now I'm about retired. I'm supposed to be retired, but that office is a nice write-off, you know. So, but you see, that confidence that we get that we had lost completely with our drinking, I had lost everything. Without drinking, no confidence in myself. I had all the fears that any man ever had. And this disease of alcoholism that we have, you know, is made up of this emotional instability to the nth degree. You know, you see the guy get up and he says, I'm an alcoholic because my father dropped me on my head when I was 4 years old. Or I'm an alcoholic because I was raised on the wrong side of the tracks or the right side of the tracks. I'm an alcoholic because my family were alcoholics. Or I'm an alcoholic because my father was a preacher. I've heard that four times. I'm an alcoholic because I have a physical intolerance to alcohol. It's simple. And they say 10% of us have this allergy or in whatever it is to alcohol. So what's so terrible about that? My oldest girl, she used to get asthma. We find out finally that she was allergic to albumin. And when she'd eat a cake or something that had the white of an egg in it, she couldn't breathe. So you see, this is the same thing as we have with these alcoholics. Basically, I am an alcoholic because of my physical intolerance to alcohol. That's basically. Now, what happens to me when I get on these terrible drunks, and when I would start drinking, I never could get enough, and none of us could. And we deteriorate emotionally because of the things we did and the way we slide down the ladder so fast, to the point that any time anything hurts us emotionally, we need some medicine, and that medicine is alcohol. And having this intolerance for alcohol, when we take one drink, we're on our way. And, you know, emotional hurt is about 1,000 times worse than physical hurt because you can't put your finger on it. And I got to the point where I was just like a little child. Anything that got me upset emotionally, and I got this hurt, I had to have some medicine. And I talked to friends of mine who were not alcoholic, and they'd say, what the hell's the matter with you? They couldn't figure it out, and neither could I. I was like the child who lays on the floor and kicks his feet and cries when it's upset emotionally. The only difference was I went over to the bar and got drunk. So all I have to do is look at my former life. If I'm going to a wedding, I'm emotionally high. I have to get drunk. If I'm going to a funeral, I'm emotionally low. I have to get drunk. And you know something? For me, it works out very beautifully. Because I know that I will be an emotional person the rest of my life. I'm either low or I'm high. That even key right in there, no. That's too much like a vegetable, and I don't want to live like a vegetable. I have to hurt sometimes, and then I have to be happy sometimes. And we drunks go to extreme in this respect. And they tell me that 10% of all the people in the world are like us. Hell, I spoke down in New Zealand back in 69, so my wife and I went around the world. I spoke in Singapore and Malaysia. All Asians, except three sailors from one of our ships was there. One of the guys, I've met him a lot since then. And here we have 30, 40 guys. There was Japs who were Buddhists. We had Chinese. We had Thais. We had Malaysians. We had a lot of Mohammedans from India. And you know, they're not even supposed to drink tea. And there were two black men from South Africa in the consular service there. We had the damnedest meeting you ever saw. Here, we get the idea that just certain people, like Irishmen, are alcoholics, you know. Of course, there are a hell of a lot of them, especially priests. And it... But no matter where we went, it was the same thing, you know. No matter where we went, it was the same thing. 10% of all the people in the world are or will become alcoholics if they drink to any degree at all. Now, some people say it's the amount of drink booze that you drink that causes the disease. Well, that's all right. Everybody's got a right to their own opinion. But to me, I am an alcoholic because I have that something. And out of seven boys in my family, I'm the only alcoholic. And three girls. And I'm not the youngest, and I'm not the oldest, and there's a, you know, the old psychs, they all... I know seven practicing psychiatrists that are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you see? Now, that head shrinker that I went to, he could have maybe done me some good. But I wasn't very honest with him. But I don't think he could have ever done me any good as far as the disease of alcoholism. This is the first thing that has ever come along in the history of mankind where we can stay sober as a group of people. It's the only thing that's ever come along. No human power could help us that God could and would have sought. It's very simple. We put in the action and God takes care of the rest of it. I had a little piano player friend of mine. Little Fidgy. Fidgy stood about 5'4". And he was playing at CBS in the radio days, 500 a week. Had a beautiful home out in Santa Monica. Had a nice family, a couple of boys, a couple of automobiles, and beautiful wife, the world with a tail. And Fidgy started the drinking. And my God, nothing flat. He lost his job, he lost his home, he lost his family. And he's out there, and just in a matter of months, he's out there playing for $50 a week in these piano bars. And he was a fabulous piano player. And he got a job way out on the edge of Los Angeles. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, he gets through, but the buses stop running, so he can't get back to town. He found himself a room for $10 a week. And then he went back to the piano bar, and he found out that he could take a shortcut back to that room through a little cemetery. So every morning at 2 o'clock in the morning, he's drunkard and $700, and he follows this little path through the cemetery, and he never gets in trouble, never gets pinched. But one morning, he's awfully drunk, and it's cold, and it's damp. And he starts through this little cemetery following this winding path. And by God, he got off the path and he fell in a hole that was dug for a funeral the next day. And here's a poor little bastard down to the bottom of that hole. He can't reach the top and he's screaming and hollering. Tuxedo on, a stiff shirt, and a whole ball of wax. About dawn, an old wino come wandering through this little cemetery. And he hears this bell ring. And he walked around and he found our little piano player down at the bottom of this hole. And now he's absolutely pooped out. He's laying on his back, his hands out. Tuxedo on and everything. The old wino says, "What's the matter down there?" He says, "Get me out of here. I'm freezing to death. Get me out of here. I'm freezing to death." The wino looked at him a minute and he says, "No wonder you're freezing to death. You've kicked all your dirt off." I was working in the studios. I worked at RKO most of the time in the old days when we did a lot of pictures there. You know, now where a studio used to do 300 pictures a year, they're doing about 30. So anyway, there's a place called the Melrose Grotto right on Melrose Boulevard there in Hollywood. And RKO studios are right here, and over here is Paramount Studios. And when all of us musicians were working there, and we worked a real lot, both of us at the same time, we'd always end up over at the bar, over at the Melrose Grotto. It was a great big long bar. All stools. No booze or nothing. All stools. And we're up there. We're over there one day and about 4 o'clock. And, of course, I'm always there at 4 o'clock when I get off. And somebody poked me and he says, "Look, here comes Fidgy." And my God, through the door comes my little piano player. He looks like death warmed over. He'd been on a big drunk. His whiskers were down to here. He'd puked all over himself. His clothes were all torn. He was a mess. And he comes skidding through there, and he pulled himself up on that stool, and he hit the bar, and he says, John, the bartender's name was John, give me a drink. You know, I'm the best damn piano player in the world. I can just play anything. And he could, by the way. And he says, just give me a drink. And finally, one of the musicians got tired of hearing his beller, and he says, there's a piano over there. Go over and play it. Let's hear you play anything. And he says, I'll just show you. So he skidded off the stool and started for the piano. My God, when he turned around, the seat of his pants were out and his ass was hanging out. My God, the piano, the bartender saw this just as he sat down, and he ran around the bar and he says, do you know your ass is hanging out? And Fidgy looked at him a minute and he says, no, but he says, you just sing a few bars and I'll follow you. I like to talk a great deal about the steps, but I'd just like to say something about one step especially that seemed to help me so very, very much, because it took a lot of application, a lot of study, and a lot of thinking. I'll never forget one of the older men in AA then says, you're thinking again, aren't you? You're thinking. I was asking him how he practiced the fourth step. And that's the step on taking an inventory, which was just intriguing to me. And around L.A. for many, many years, they called me Fourth Step Al, because that's all I wanted to talk about. I studied the book thoroughly from beginning to end, and Bill says so many times that we all have certain defects of character, and they run very much in a parallel with all alcoholics, the same defects of character. And you know, these defects of character arise in our daily life and get us into a great big emotional spin, and we get drunk. So what I want to do is sit down and be honest with me and recognize these defects of character, because this is all I'm worried about. I'm not worried about what I did before. If I started to sit down and take an inventory of my life since I could remember it, I'd cut my throat. The things that I did to my friends and their wives and a lot of other things that went on when I was drunk. Things that I want to forget. I have to be good to myself. They tell me in AA, be good to yourself for God's sakes. And forgive yourself for so terrible things that you did when you were drunk to yourself and your family and your friends. And if we don't do that, we're going to cut our own throat. So today is the first day of my life. And so here's the way I took my fourth step. And it still works for me. I wrote down my defects of character. The things that always got me in a big spin. And this is where we call the self-honesty of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the worst defect of character that I have, and the one that possibly got me started on more drunks, was self-pity or frustration. So I wrote that down. And the second worst defect of character that I have that started me on so many drunks was resentments. It's poison to the mind. And the third worst defect of character that I have is intolerance. And I still have a lot of these things, but I recognize them now. And the fourth worst defect of character that I have is selfishness. And this is my inventory. And it goes a lot further than that, because I find out in my daily life, when I start getting emotionally upset by something, and this is where we get the self-honesty again, I can recognize very quickly what defect of character that is affecting me at this time. And did you know that recognition, an honest recognition of these things, is 90% of the job? That's 90% of the job. We admit to ourselves. We admit to ourselves. And this is the beautiful part of the whole thing. God takes care of these things when we admit to ourselves and start being honest. And on the other side of the ledger, I was 38 years old when I came into AA. And I could work if I could get a job. And I had one friend in the world, and that was my girlfriend, who we've been married now, just 6 months short of my sobriety. And she's wonderful. She's a wonderful person. Because she drank with me and caroused with me until I got into AA, and she just flipped right over just like I did. We stopped that crazy life. We got a nice home. We got everything that any human being could ever want. And so thousands of friends. And that guy Eccles says that the people don't like me. Everybody loves me. I love everybody. And whether they like me or not, I don't give a damn. I'm happy. I'm happy as hell. And then we get down to that 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps. And I don't know whether you feel that this is dry when I talk AA, but I have to tell you a few of the highlights of the things that I've learned in my 38 years nearly. What is a spiritual awakening? What is this business? Spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. So not to drop names, I knew Bill Wilson real well. We stayed with him two different weekends at their home. They stayed at our home for a couple days one time on the QT. Nobody knew about it because they'd think it was terrible of Bill to do that with just one and not everybody. And I says, what's this spiritual experience, Bill? Is the sky going to fall or the bells going to ring? What is this? I don't understand it. He says, you haven't been reading the book, have you? And I says, oh, yeah, I've been reading the book. And he says, well, when you get past the stories. And I says, what stories? I says, I don't read those stories. They're as phony as a $3 bill. I know a couple of the stories and the people that wrote them, and you put them in there, and that ain't them. They just had a good writer, is all. Wrote a good story. But I didn't know there was anything after the story, so I never went so far. He pays a $5.69. He says, read that. He said, there's a chapter on the spiritual experience. And I says, I'll be damned there is. A change in our personality and our attitudes is the true spiritual awakening. And it's something that comes to 99% of us very, very gradual. And we don't realize when it's happening ourselves. So here we are back to practicality and common sense again. And that's what the whole program is. Practicality and common sense. And he says the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in different forms. Upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, he tells us, is a true spiritual experience or the spiritual awakening. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reactions to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. And I wrote this last paragraph in this because Bill had it all screwed up in the first edition. Now, this is the truth. So I got a couple lines in the book, you know. That's what you get for getting sober so long ago. He said in here, we find that no one need have difficulty with the spiritual side of the program. Well, you and I know that there are no sides to this program. You hear these dodos get up and say, I got drunk because I didn't get the spiritual side. There's no such thing as a side. The whole thing is spiritual because it is all good and it is all positive. So he says, well, you write it, and here's what I wrote. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. So that takes in the whole thing. So I feel pretty proud of that, pretty proud. I'm telling the master that he's wrong. Action is the magic word. We try to live this program, these 12 steps, to the best of our ability. And God takes care of the rest. The whole thing is wound up in one thing, and it's so simple. It's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we definitely have a change in our attitudes and our personality and our sense of values. God takes care of everything. And we're all miracles. We're all miracles. No human power could help us. And this boy was 4 years old and had become completely blind. And his family took him all over the world where they heard about great eye surgeons and great eye doctors. And no one was able to even diagnose why he couldn't see. So now he's growing up into a great, fine-looking young man. He got his college degree. He looked beautiful. He had everything in the world, but he was totally blind. And then a young doctor moved into this city where they lived, a surgeon, an eye surgeon specialist, and he performed a couple miraculous operations on friends of theirs, and they could see again. So the boy went to him, and the doctor says, from what you tell me, it'll take me some time to diagnose just what you can't see. And after a couple months, he called the boy, and he says, I think I have the proper diagnosis. It'll mean an operation. And the boy says, let's go. So they went to the hospital, and he operated on the boy, and he laid up in his bed in the hospital for 15 to 25 days with bandages over his eyes after the operation. Perfectly still. He had to stay perfectly still. And then the day came, and the doctor called up the family, and he says, tomorrow we will find out whether the operation was a success or not. So the whole family is standing around the bed in this hospital room. The doctor slowly took these bandages off the boy's eyes. And when he got them completely off his eyes, the boy opened his eyes, and my God, he could see light. And his eyes started to focus, and he could see his family. And he grabbed the doctor by the hand, and he says, doctor, I don't know how to thank you. I just don't know how to thank you. The doctor says, my boy, don't thank me. All I did was put in the stitches, and God took care of the rest. And all we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is put in the stitches, and God takes care of the rest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Al. Thank you, people. We'll close this meeting in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer. Mary will lead us.
Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.
Keep coming back.